So as I just said, it's been 50 years since the March on Washington, where Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. And in that 50 years, you know, we've come a long way. There's been a lot of progress that's been made. But every year and every day and every week, there's always something in the news about where we are in Milwaukee is in terms of social issues and economic issues that aren't necessarily favorable to the city. So if you just look at that, you'd say Milwaukee is a place that I don't want to go. And so one of the questions that I have is that really where we are in Milwaukee? Is that the reality here? And I guess I'm going to throw that question to whomever wants to answer first. What do you see as one of the the biggest problems we're facing here in Milwaukee right now? Anyone want to take that?
Well, sure. I think I'm a Milwaukee native, but I've also lived in other places and I've lived overseas. And I'm a big fan of Milwaukee. And you know how we talk about when you have problems with your family, you sort of talk about those problems in your house, but then you don't like other people to criticize your family. That's kind of how I feel about it, depending on who I'm talking about with. If I'm talking with other Milwaukeeans, I very freely talk about our problems and our struggles. But when people start labeling Milwaukee as this or that, or the worst city in the world, or, you know, say that we're the most segregated city in the country, I mean, some of it is factual, some of it is perception. And I feel like a perception can be just as damaging as reality. And so I'm very cognizant of when people are just sort of slandering the city without it being rooted in facts.
So what do you see as not being based in fact? And this is for any of you.
That there are no good things here. I mean, there are, like Alex, I'm a Milwaukee native as well. I lived in the South for 15 years. I came back home because I was homesick for my city. And I am very invested in the health of this city. We do have issues going on here. We have a lot of things that have to be addressed. And folks are not making the distinction between, you know, things that are attacking legislation that attacks Milwaukee County that comes from the state versus things that are going on in the city and how, you know, the county is being, you know, their hands are tied in some things because there are other agendas working against us. This is my home, and I have never regretted coming home.
And I think I would add to that, I think Alex and Angela are correct to think that there's a perception about Milwaukee, and I think Milwaukee just has a ton of resources, a ton of assets that people forget about and they overlook. I remember in none of my working circles where people would ask me all the time, how can you live in Milwaukee? And I can't believe they would even have the frame of context to say why. And so I think that's an issue. But to go back to the larger question, I do would say that there is a problem within Milwaukee, but it's a problem that's connected, I think, throughout this country with specifically African Americans and African American families. And even that's a larger issue, I do think it affects Milwaukee, and I do think that is a part of the conversation for our city. In order for our city to thrive and to continue to thrive, we have to take a look at the African American family.
I would agree with that. In retrospect, in regard to a Latino framework, you know, family is everything. And Alex, you kind of kicked it off in saying the aspect of, you know, you want things kept within the family, but you don't talk about it on the outside. I'm native born. I also moved to Illinois for a while and then came back. This is my home. I look at situations that occur within Milwaukee and within the state of Wisconsin's opportunities. What can we do as Latinos here? How do we work with other community leaders? What can we do with our education system? It's a difference to notice something, but then there's a difference to make a difference and to take action. And I think that that's really where we're headed towards is the action and teaming together with other organizations that bring us together. An example that I'll give is the aspect of the Sikh temple. A very unfortunate situation that occurred. However, seeing so many diverse groups coming together with that tragedy and coming together just to talk about how many things that we have in common, that's what makes the difference.
And the outgrowth of that it has been youth groups serve to unite so that that commonality and that desire to find solutions and that desire to take action is finding a channel through which to act. And I love Milwaukee as well as anybody. I think the people of Milwaukee are its greatest asset. And, I mean, the whole city, all the population and the diverse population of the city. And I think where we need to go from here is to recognize who is doing what and how that is a positive contribution to the city. And then what can we as a city, what can we as citizens in the city do to foster and encourage all those good things that are going on. I think too often they're ignored. I hear people talk about, oh, these young people today, you just can't do anything with them. They're so violent. They're so this, they're so that. But I work a lot with youth groups, and I see young people who are hungry for a sense of purpose, and when they discover one, you cannot stop them from being agents for positive change in their community.
If I could just like follow up on that, you know, when I said, I didn't mean to convey, don't talk about problems outside of Milwaukee, but you know, you hear just these random statistics that are thrown out, sort of to bash Milwaukee. Oh, look, you have 50% unemployment, African American men. You know, what's wrong with Milwaukee? It's easy to just sort of simply, on a surface level, look at that without digging into, you know, what are the issues and the complexity of, you know, you also have. You have John Daniels, who's chairman of one of the largest law firms in Milwaukee. You have Common Council President Hines, the first African American in history to be Common Council President more than one term. You have Will Allen. You have all these leaders. And the young men, which Peggy was talking about, I mean, I live in a neighborhood. It's probably 80 to 90% African American. A lot of young men who are sort of off the grid. You know, they're not applying for jobs. They don't have resumes. But as Peggy said, they have loads of potential and talent, and they feel disconnected from the system. So you can just throw out that number and say, oh, 50% unemployment, you guys should do something about that. Or you can actually get to know Skyler, who lives across the street from me, who has these great cooking skills, and I was able to take him to MATC. Now he has a culinary degree. Now he's doing well. I think to enter into the situation of an individual, and that's what really comes across in this speech to me that Dr. King gave, is that we're all individuals, and none of us are sort of off the hook. You know, he says at one point, in the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. And I think that goes for all of us. You know, there are suburbanites who sort of kind of spew out this hatred and bitterness toward the city. There are people in the city who spew out hatred and bitterness toward the suburbs. None of that is productive. And I think you have to enter in to each situation and look at everyone as an individual with strengths and challenges.
But now, how do we make people take ownership for that? I think as a Milwaukee and someone who works in the city, someone who owns a property in the city but is a suburbanite, I have to look realistically at these numbers. And I think we all sitting around this table here, and there's so many people doing such positive things that want to focus on the bright spots. How far does that go? And is that really going to change these numbers? I mean, think about the dollars and the resources that are allocated towards all of these programs, where I think people aren't talking about how do we really solve the issue. They're raising money for this, or they're rallying people around this. How do we come together? I think there's a lot to be said for what's going on, you know, at City Hall or, you know, at the county level. How do we get on the same page to really address this issue that we all talk about?
I think it's difficult to get on the same page because I think there's a lot of people who don't live in Milwaukee who've kind of viewed it as a failed project, that, you know, deindustrialization or deunionization and all the problems that are befitting one half of the city, almost a whole half of the city, that, you know, we should just throw our hands up in the air. But I also think part of that is a perception issue that's pushed by certain interests, certain media interests, certain political interests, that it benefits them to have Milwaukee be weak, to have Milwaukee be going down. And I'm not a native of Milwaukee. I've lived here for almost 10 years. I've lived in other places too. And I mean, really, compared to other big cities in this country, we're doing very well. There are some serious, serious, serious issues, but in the other places I've lived, on the East Coast and other places, we're doing much better than other places. We have some fantastic, thriving neighborhoods, even in the places that people think are, you know, dangerous or scary or they've failed. There are good people. They're very good people. They're good homeowners. They're good families. And how do we fix it? It's, I think we could probably sit here for a couple of days and talk about all that. But I think getting maybe some jobs. And how do you do that? That's probably above my pay grade. I don't know.
You've got to start somewhere. And if we could say education is an issue, if we could say crime is an issue, gun violence is an issue, why can't we identify that one issue and just allocate our resources towards it?
I would say I think there is one issue. And this is difficult, I think, for not just for the urbanites and for the suburbanites, from my white brothers and sisters, my Hispanic brothers and sisters, and my black. I think the issue, at least for me, the key issue is empowerment. And for so long, this country, people have been so scared of specific communities being empowered and not allowing them just to move forward and empower them. What I mean by that is that you rarely hear people say, listen, and I wish some of my conservative brothers and sisters would say this, I can't help you out. I don't have the money, the resources, the time, or I'm just tired out. But listen, you can do this. You have the resources. A lot of times you hear what I can't do. And as an African-American growing up in the city of Milwaukee, I was used to that. You know, you can't do this. We don't want you living here. We don't want you doing this. We don't want you shopping here. If that is the case, even if racism lies alive and well, you know what? Listen, I don't know what it's like to live in the hood, as people would say. But you have the resources to change your community. You never hear that empowerment message. You don't hear from my conservative brothers and sisters as far as they're playing up to their constituency. You don't even hear from my liberal brothers and sisters who are playing up saying, we need more government. Even if you took away government and took away all the social programs, I hear more messages about not smoking as opposed to being a father. You know, I would love to see a commercial that says, you know what, 60% of African-American boys and children won't grow up without a father. We need you to be a father. You don't hear those messages. To me, and I guess I'm a marketing guy, I would love to see us market those values, those principles, so we don't have to spend another dime on welfare and just say, you know, we took welfare away, and I guess that would be some of my conservatives, brothers and sisters, that would be their dream, which is fine. But then why aren't we saying, listen, though, the stats say if there's a mother and father in this household, you know, I hear more about gay rights. I hear more about every other issue when it comes to the African-American people, specifically in the city of Milwaukee and around this country. Rarely do I come on the television. I come on the radio and say, you know what? If you educate your child, you don't hear about education. You don't hear about fathers. You don't hear about unemployment. I would love to say, listen, if you're looking for a job, a 30-second spot, pull your pants up. You don't hear that. All you hear is that how bad we are as a people, how we're a black eye to the city of Milwaukee because our employment. You never hear the empowerment message. I won't spend another dime on you, but listen, here's how I made it. You don't hear those stories, specifically coming from the outsiders of this.
Let me pick up the racism point that you touched on just a minute ago, because I think that needs elaboration. I worked for 28 years in Waukesha County. I heard how people talk about coming to Milwaukee. I know people who have come to Milwaukee and gone all the way to Good Hope Road before, and then down to 43 before they come downtown because they're trying to avoid everything that's dangerous. I think Milwaukee is a code word outside of Milwaukee for African American, or it's a code word for people of color. And I think we have to address that racism. I think we have to call it out for what it is.
Well, I think as a person of color, I mean, I grew up in outstate Wisconsin. It is a code word. There's this idea that it's some sort of almost – it's almost silly. It's like this comic book-like dystopia. And I think if people really got in, I mean, just go to the Fond du Lac Avenue Farmers Market on a Saturday. People would think that, you know, I don't want to go to Fond du Lac Avenue. It's a wonderful place.
It's beautiful.
Some great vegetables and see good people.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second, though, right? So why would you want to come to Milwaukee, though, if what you hear and what you read on the daily basis about the very violent summer that we're having, or about the black male unemployment rate or the recidivism rate, or why? What's going to bring me here? How do you sell that Milwaukee is not this horrible place where if you come, you may be killed just, you know, when you step foot downtown? I don't think that's true whatsoever. And I know that's not true. I live in Milwaukee. I live in the inner city. But what I'm saying is, for those people who are afraid to come here, as you were all just talking about, how do you get the message out that, hey, that's actually not the reality of Milwaukee?
I think some of it's on you, LaToya. No, I don't mean you. But I mean it's some of it's on the media. Because, I mean, we just had this great celebration at Bronzeville Week. There was no violence. We celebrated all these entrepreneurs, all these young businesses, old businesses, businesses that are leaving suburban areas, coming to MLK, Alderwoman Coggs, and all these business leaders. I can't think of all the names. There's so many business leaders, private sector leaders who brought all this vitality this last week to Brownsville. I don't know that I read one article about it. Now, if there is a shooting, we may see six or seven articles about it. You know, I have relatives. I have close family members in Waukesha and Brookfield. I had one of them come up to me and say, there is a shooting in downtown Milwaukee every day. I said, that's just completely wrong. There hasn't been a shooting in downtown Milwaukee since President Teddy Roosevelt was shot by a white guy. So, I mean, you know, people have these perceptions. And the reverse also, Keith and I, when we were working in City Hall, I just shared this really quickly. We had a guy from New York come, and he said, there is no city in the world better for African-American men than Milwaukee. We said, oh, that's interesting. We don't hear that very often. What do you mean? He said, you can buy a property in the city of Milwaukee for a dollar. And this is what he did. And you can rehab it, and you can build a business. And in New York, you can't buy anything for a dollar. He said, you can't buy an empty lot for $500,000. But I came to Milwaukee because I saw opportunity. And everywhere I look, I see opportunity. And Keith mentioned the mindset. You know, you can have a mindset of empowerment, which this young African-American man did. You know, he's a millionaire now. He's a self-made man. He had a mindset of empowerment when he came to this city. Or you can have a mindset of defeatism. And everywhere you look, and I'm not someone who says racism doesn't exist. I see it all the time. I see young men in my neighborhood getting, you know, having to sit on the curb with their hands behind their back just if they get pulled over for speeding. I've never had to sit on a curb when I've gotten pulled over for speeding. I've never seen a white person have to sit on a curb. So racism does exist. Not just police, but all different spheres. At the same time, I see people like Keith, and I see people like this gentleman I'm talking about, who have a mindset that I really can do anything, and I have this great potential and this great talent. And I agree with Keith. I think that's what we need to tap into.
I think Tracy's question is definitely one to address. How do we pull together so that the message gets out? And I'm frustrated by the fact that the good that I see happening, especially with young people, because that's where I've been working recently, is ignored. And, you know, if people already think you're violent, well, then you don't have a lot to lose by being violent. So have to create a different image, have to get the image out there. I don't talk about the mainstream media. I talk about the corporate-controlled media. It's not interested in getting that message out. So what are the tools at our available to us to get that message out?
I mean, do you think that some of it is, I mean, not only structural with, you know, our government entities, but you know, a lot of our nonprofits pulling together. I mean, Northwestern Mutual just did some very wonderful collaborative research looking at how, you know, these organizations that are pulling the youth together, giving them the empowerment that they deserve and that they need, working with these nonprofit organizations to say, this is a real problem. This is where we're going to funnel our efforts, and incentivizing these nonprofits to work together on trying to achieve success. And I think it not only comes from your corporate community, but, I mean, government. We need to be pulling in one direction. And if I could leave with one message, it would be please, please figure out what your priorities are, and we will rally around it because it is in everyone's best interest, corporate, public, private. I think that it's in everyone's best interest if we can establish those priorities. And if it's jobs, it's jobs. If it's education, it's education. And if it's teen pregnancy, it's teen pregnancy. I would figure out where to start.
I think the biggest thing is more attention to a family atmosphere for the kids. Just a little history for you. In 1963, the black families headed by married couples was 70%. Today, about the reverse is true. It's also, you know, around 70%. I think the you know, as the saying goes, all change in America begins at the dinner table. And what you need to do is the kids need to be held accountable for their actions. You know, you can pump all this money into schools, but it's not going to go anywhere if the kids don't straighten their stuff up and pull up their pants or cut themselves dressed and make sure their homework is done.
Well, can I just challenge one thing? I think there is some validity for sure to what you're saying. I mean, and that's what Dr. King says in his speech. He says all of us can do better. At the same time, you know, what I shared about earlier about, I mean, I've seen young men in my neighborhood who are going to college. They're doing everything that they're supposed to do.
Sure.
And but there's a perception of them where people see them as scary, and people see them as, oh, they may not fit my quote unquote corporate mold, or you know. I mean, I've seen this happen again and again where someone – there's a woman, you know, there's a woman who has a PhD. She's an African-American woman. And there's an HR department in our city that thought she wasn't a good candidate for a program for a job she was overqualified for, or she was eminently qualified for, I should say. I mean, this happens again and again. I had an experience where some young men in my neighborhood, they were just kind of talking to me, kind of being a little bit loud like I was when I was in high school going to Whitefish Bay. Four police officers came out of the darkness, just threw them on the ground without them saying anything. Now they have a ticket. I had to talk to their police captain to get that ticket waived. But it was just because they were, you know, just being a little bit loud. I just think there's less room for error with African-American men especially. Whereas me, as a Caucasian man, you know, there's more latitude. I can get second, third, fourth, fifth chances. I have a broad network. You know, I have generational means and generational wealth, so I'm not trying to let people off the hook. But I think it's more complex than to just say young African American men need to do better, because there are times when they absolutely do need to be held into account. They need to do better, and they need to pull up their pants. There are other times when they pull up their pants and they put on a suit and tie and they do everything right and they go into the job interview, but the odds are stacked against them.
But a company is going to hire the best qualified candidate.
Yeah. You would hope.
As a woman, mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about, you know, pay parity and equality as well. And we had a recent situation where a friend of mine was on a nominating committee for a board position. And they were looking at a number of candidates. One happened to be a woman. And she said, I would love to give this position to the woman. But she wasn't the best qualified candidate. And I think that woman would understand why she wasn't chosen for that position. And I think if it's about the equal opportunity. And I think that really, you know, getting back to some of the points made earlier, is there equal opportunity in the system that we have in place? And, you know, there are people saying no. Some people would say yes. And I think the bigger question is then how do we make that possible?
As a person that stands at the intersection of race and gender, and as a person who is from one of the neighborhoods that people skirt, my family's on 19th and Keefe, that people skirt when they're trying to get to the quote-unquote better parts of the city, as a person who is from a fatherless home, our issues in our communities run so further, so much deeper than pulling up your pants. I mean, I hear that so much. I can understand where it comes from, but the whole idea of if you're just respectable enough, things will be different for you, that is not my reality. I'm sorry, but it's built into the system that certain groups are not to have access no matter what you do. There was a police chief stopped and frisked in a suit in New York. Being dressed respectably, quote unquote, did not save him. I understand what your point is, that, you know, you have to value education. You have to value those things. But if you are coming out of a system and your environment where you are told constantly that you are not to be successful, that those are not things that you need to even be thinking about, that you are never going to get past this point, what do we expect to see on our streets when you have taken, you know, it takes a long time for people. You can tell someone something over and over and over again. Certain people are not going to accept that. But there are a whole lot of people who are when they don't see anything different. So what I'm looking at is, I understand, you know, pull your pants up. I get all that, because I'm sure as a 39-year-old grandmother, I've said the same thing to people. But at the same time, we have to look much deeper. The root is not in respectability. Poverty is violence.
I will say this, Angela. I think I totally agree with you. Martin Luther King's speech was about jobs and freedom. At least that's what I figure with my quick Google research and listening to the speech. But with that being said, I had a brain freeze about a year ago. I went to a community brainstorming meeting. I don't know if anyone's familiar with those community brainstorm. They happen, I think, once a month at St. Matthew's CME. Great event. And a UWM group of students, graduate students, that did a report, and it was the same statistics. African-American males are the last hire, first fired. And they was going through all the statistics, and I totally understood them. But what bothered me was that I was looking around the room, and I saw 60, 70, even 80-year-old people shaking hands. See? And they kept saying, see? Told you. No one wants to listen to us. See? Told you. No one wants to listen to us. And it bothered me that seeing that image. And the only metaphor that I could come up with for the African-American community, and that's why I really, my Hispanic brothers and sisters, I think they got us when it comes to this, is that my metaphor is that within the African-American community, something happened with the baby boomer generation, with King's generation, where we came up to a stop sign. And we can put that stop sign as racism. We can put that stop sign as anything, even gender issues, social issues. And instead of acknowledging the stop sign but saying that we're going to put the gas to the pedal and still move forward, we stopped. We got out the car. We looked. And we've been there ever since. And it bothers me when I go to some of these events and I hear, and people, for some reason, especially with the baby boomer generation, they want validation that racism still exists. And my issue is like, so what? It's been here since the beginning of time. It will be here long gone when we're gone. My problem is that why haven't we said to ourselves, like my Hispanic brothers and sisters have said, that we're going to move forward no matter what? We have children that our own children are dying. Our own children are not being educated. Our communities. So if you don't like me, if you don't hire me because I'm black, so what? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to at least get up in the morning and sweep my porch. I'm going to at least get up and clean my street. At least I'm going to get up and go to Menards and get some off-color paint for a dollar and paint my porch. For some reason, we've lost a disconnect just because racism exists. Now, oh, we can't do anything. When I see brothers hanging on the corners, I get it, man. You don't have a job. That does not mean to give you the right to intimidate people. It doesn't give you the right to treat people with disrespect. It doesn't give you the right to shoot a bus driver in the leg if that would happen. It bothers me that for some reason, this generation, the baby boomer generation, and every generation afterwards within African-American community has got stuck on racism like it never existed. It's always will be here. And like I said, I would reference other communities who say, you know what exists, so what? We're going to, you know, if I got to get a cart and put some tacos in a cart and walk around my neighborhood and sell it, I'm going to do it. But I'm not going to let anyone determine my destiny. And that's what bothers me. Something happened with the gatekeeping within our community about principles and morals and values. Yes, racism exists. But still, what happened that we didn't say, I'm not going to let my son die or my daughter die or my son and daughter not get educated just because someone is not going to hire me. So what? You're not going to hire me? I'm going to keep going. You know, I think about my grandfather who came in Milwaukee in 1947. He's on 41st and Center. Great guy. Been there forever. And he kept going. He said, I kept knocking on the door until he found a job all on the South Side in 1947. And it bothers me that we have now let that spirit of entrepreneurship, of community, of family go while everyone is leaving us. And frankly, people are giving up. They've given up. One generation, the baby boomer generation, tried it, and they said they're done, they're sick of it, and they're closing the door, and that bothers me.
What I find it, when I talk to young people, and I am the baby boom generation, I am, participated in the movement for fair housing, among other things. When I go to talk about those events, I don't talk about them to indulge in nostalgia. I know there are some people for whom the door opened and they walk through and they see the civil rights movement as having been successful and that's the end of it. And they are the ones holding up the stop sign. But that, you know, I just am a little uncomfortable with the degree of your generalization. Because what I see is that Milwaukee has a tradition of young people standing up for justice. And when young people today find that out, that history that has been kept from them, they find it tremendously empowering. Particular case in point are the students at Nova High School who studied the Milwaukee Civil Rights Movement, did a museum exhibit about it, and went on from there to call a youth summit conference at their school this spring. 100 students came, and they began to talk among themselves about it, precisely in the terms that you're talking about. Okay, let's move ahead. What do we need to work on? What bothers us the most? So I see energy that wasn't lost, that is looking for and sometimes finding channels in which it can operate. And you know, I think the racism and economic problems, and they are related, are great, so that it takes a multiplicity of approaches to deal with it. So if your approach is different than mine, I think that's fine, because we have to work on different things. I know one person, Andre Lee Ellis, a theater producer and director, who among the other things that he does is have a garden in his inner city neighborhood. And there he is out working in the garden, and young people who are unemployed, who have nothing to do, step by and say, "What are you doing, man?" You know, and he tells them what he's doing, and he gets talking to them and gets them gardening. And then while they're gardening, they're talking about, okay, what else do we want to do? So I see energy just percolating there across the city, and maybe there is some stop sign. I'm not sure it's a self-imposed stop sign. I think some of the stop signs come from economic institutions. I think some of the stop signs come from the state legislature. I think some of the stop signs come from all kinds of places.
You talk a lot about a lot of great things that serve as fuel. So we talk about what's the catalyst and what's going to make the real change. We talk about bottom up. We talk about top down. I have often wondered, you know, what as for our country, we have our first African American president, and how has that served to fuel this conversation? What has that done to the spirit? What has that done for that message of empowerment? And, you know, as you know, someone who has asked these questions for many years, I wonder.
You know, I want to go back with Keith. I think he's made some really great points in regard to, unfortunately, I do not have a taco cart. I'm El Salvadorian. I do appreciate, though.
I don't think he said Hispanic. And, he said anyone could have a taco cart.
And then the ability to be that. And I know you would be there, right? No. But that aspect of being that entrepreneur. And I when I look at Latinos and I look at, you know, what we do in the League of United Latin American Citizens, there's three factors that come out very clearly to me. And that's the aspect of family, faith, and perseverance. Much of what we're dealing with right now is the whole aspect of immigration. So we're going back to the days of the Germans. We're coming back to the days of the Irish coming. We're dealing with right now what the perception is of what a Latino, or as some may say, a Hispanic. I prefer, as an Xer, I'm a Latino, Central American. That Hispanic was designed for a census as a checkbox by Caucasian to how to categorize Latinos. So I look at the aspect of those three factors, which gives me energy, you know, and I need the energy from our youth and what we try to do with LULAC to empower our youth, how we serve as leaders within our community, and the importance that we've really put as Latino leaders, that we're connecting. Whether we agree or we disagree, LULAC is nonpartisan. And we go times where it's comfortable, it's uncomfortable, but we have to have those discussions. And I think this is a great opportunity to have those discussions. Our realization of what everyone is. You may look at me and say, ella mira una güera. She doesn't look like she's Latina. People may not think there's Salvadorians that are here in Milwaukee, you know. But that's this discussion that we have of how we empower and understand all about the aspect of perception. And that's what we're able to do today. And I think it's with family, the reason I put out family is because where does it start? I'm not saying that your family has to be a man, a woman, a child. I'm saying if there's a little boy in your neighborhood, you gave the example, Alex. You gave the example of picking that person that's across the street, being that neighbor to that individual, bringing them along, look at how many different festivals that we have in Milwaukee. Opening up your eyes, having those schools that embrace other cultures and having our children understand that. Driving to other towns, experiencing other foods, going to synagogues, going to other churches, it all begins there. I think that's where it begins of where we need to head. So put the generational, and I appreciate the fact that you said generational, because Latinos deal with the same aspect. First generation, second generation, third generation, question, why do you have to go to college? Why are you not going to be in, you know, the traditional woman that you're going to be home, you're going to have the children? Those are all the factors, but the more that we try to understand and have sit-downs exactly like this and bring our community leaders and people that are just everyday Joes like us, that's what's going to make the difference of what we see in the future.
Now, I would like to touch on something that Alex has kind of in a roundaway brought up a couple of times, and it's segregation in Milwaukee. We're often cited as one of the most segregated cities in the country. And Alex has said that, you know, I live in a neighborhood that's 90% black. Alex is a white guy, obviously. And so the question is, are we really that segregated here? What's your take on that?
Well, there's census data from 2010 that shows Milwaukee's dissimilarity score was 79.6. And to put that in context, a level of 60 is actually very high segregated.
You said dissimilarity?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's like a, I don't know, like a base score. I don't know what the highest number is, but that's like the bar level is 60.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I think it was the Business Week Insider from last week that I pulled that from. So, I mean, it showed like a map of like the 20th cities, or 22, I think it was, or 21. And Milwaukee was actually number 20. Number one was like Cincinnati or something like that.
So I think that the census data, you know, reveals one part of the discussion, and I'm not always comfortable in this seat, but I'll just throw this out there that just because you have an African American neighborhood or Latino neighborhood doesn't necessarily mean it's segregated. So it can, you know, Keith and I talk a lot about Halliard Park. You know, Halliard Park is this wonderful neighborhood, upper middle class African Americans all have steady jobs. They got a nice little gathering restaurant nearby, Garfield's 502. Mm-hmm. It's all African American, and beautiful green lawns. You know, it's almost like walking into Fox Point or something. That's 100% African American neighborhood, just about. Does that mean it's a segregated neighborhood? You know, one thing that some of the older generation would say to Keith and I when we worked in City Hall, they would say, "I like living with black people. I'm more comfortable around black people." So. That's sometimes the case. Now, other times, people, because of lack of transportation or they're not – I mean, we had a realtor come to us when we were looking for a house in Sherman Park who said – he was a white guy. He said, "No, you don't want to live over there," which is, I think, illegal for a realtor to do that. So we got a new realtor. So if there are situations where African Americans are being prevented or dissuaded or disencouraged to move to certain areas, or economics are preventing them to have access to certain things – Or vice versa, you know, if a Caucasian person wants to live in an African American neighborhood and is being discouraged, I mean, that's obviously wrong. And I think there are still some elements of that. But sometimes people want to be around similar people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's always – so when I say, you know, that the census data in terms of this race lives here, equals segregation, I'm just not always comfortable with that.
And we've had this discussion before about – you know, the fact that it's based on socioeconomics. I mean, we can sit here and have this discussion and talk about going to different neighborhoods and trying different food. So many people in the inner city, I would venture to guess, have not stepped outside of, you know, they don't even know that Lake Michigan exists. Mm-hmm. And they haven't seen it. And it's because, you know, we're actually having this conversation on a totally different level from, I think, where the real problems are. And if I were to venture a guess, is that Dr. King, in his remarks, was talking not only to, you know, us sitting here around the table here, but those who are living in the inner city who don't have access to, you know, those opportunities. And how do we create that? And I think that's the question we've all asked and have tried to answer in a number of different ways. But to put that lens on, too, when we're having that discussion.
I would also say, I mean, I've lived in other places. One thing I think is striking about Milwaukee is that there really are no suburbs where there's a very large black middle class.
Yeah, that's true.
And almost every other major city, there's, you know, like in Chicago or Detroit or Washington or Baltimore or even New York, there are suburbs where, you know, that's 40, 50, even 60 or 70% black, and they're all middle class to upper middle class professionals. And that doesn't really exist here. We have a black middle class. We have some black upper class, but it's not it's one of the I think one of the most striking things about Milwaukee is that once you get to the suburbs, you can cross maybe 10 blocks. You go from 89% black to 89% white. People do enjoy living usually among people who look like them and are similar to them culturally. But I think that's the striking part. There are other cities in this country where you see similar things, where you have very white suburbs and very black inner city neighborhoods, but usually have a middle. And we don't really seem to have the middle.
You know, Tom mentioned Cincinnati. And I think we're much better than Cincinnati. I mean, Cincinnati, white people are oftentimes afraid to leave their downtown. So where we have, you know, Halyard Park, or we have the East Side, or we have Walker's Point, or I think neighborhoods around downtown are getting more stabilized, I feel like, and hopefully that's stretching out. And there are a lot of African Americans that live in Brown Deer. There are a lot of African Americans that live in Glendale. But I agree with you. I mean, it'd be nice to see more of that. I think that we don't always have the perspective of how bad some other cities are, especially if you've only lived here. I don't mean to be Pollyannish. I mean, I know that we have serious issues. And I'd be interested what Angela thinks about this, because she drives a bus, you know, throughout the city. She you know, crosses the spectrum of all different socioeconomic areas. Do you think, Angie, that do you think that we are highly segregated or more segregated than other cities?
I think we have a lot of what you all were referencing, ethnic enclaves where folks are comfortable, particularly in areas on the South Side that are Latino, which I think is awesome. But I think people are comfortable with living with people who look like them. And thank you, Alex, for that, because as a driver, I do get, you know, some of our routes, you get every portion of every demographic in this city on that bus. And it's really interesting to, as you're driving, to watch, like, say, the 23, you're leaving Calumet and up there by Vincent High School, where it's predominantly African-American with a lot of white folks up there still. And you're going down through the city into the inner city, which is mainly black folks, and then you're on the South Side where it ends up now, which is lots of Latinos and white folks and black folks, so, and lots of Asians. So we can't leave our Hmong community out as well, and Southeast Asians, because we get a lot of them, you know, in the central city as well. I think that even with people who are not, I think we're moving more towards interacting. I live in East Wauwatosa with my Puerto Rican partner. I think we might be the darkest two people in the area that I'm in, but we represent. I see a lot of diversity with young people, you know, high schoolers, middle schoolers. They are diverse groups of kids that are hanging out. I'm seeing that more and more everywhere I go. So speaking to what you said, Ms. Peggy, about youth, and you know, they're in the right direction. I mean, we blast them for a lot of things, but they are actually saying, you know, this invisible wall that used to exist between the North Side and the South Side, and you don't cross it, that doesn't exist for a lot of young people anymore. And the divide between black and brown particularly, I don't see that as much as I did when I was a kid.
No, I have to. I'm going to start steering this a little more, just because we're running out of time, and there's a couple more things that I'd like to get in. There was some talk about jobs earlier, and the fact that people need jobs. I guess I'm wondering though, is it enough just to have a job, or are we talking, what types of jobs are we talking about here? Are we looking, and do we need to provide jobs that are paying $15, $16 an hour so that people can support families, or are we saying, hey, you know, there's a local big, there's a big box store opening up, go work there for minimum wage? What are we talking about here?
I don't think it's enough just to have a job, because you can work full time at Walmart and still be on welfare. I think one of the reasons why so many African Americans came to Milwaukee in the 40s and 50s and 60s was the good jobs. And we still have some manufacturing jobs in the city, but a lot of them are out in the suburbs. And one of the big problems I can see is that if you don't have a car, you can't get out to that manufacturing job in Waukesha or New Berlin or Brookfield. And I think that might be the key right there. Have connections. If you can get to a job, you can pull up your pants and build yourself up. You have to have the income to do that. And working at a big box store making $7.25 an hour is not going to do that.
Transit access is absolutely essential. That is one of the fights that my union local has been involved in. We are also, we feel that it is intertwined with the fight for a living wage, because as you say, $7.25, I'm just going to say it, $7.25 is an insult. Folks are worth more. So we feel that transit access must be expanded and people must have the right to organize if they choose to, and they have the right to a living wage. We have to push that.
And that's a point that, you know, not only the unions have made. I know the MMAC has made that point. Tim Sullivan, former head of BUSIRIS, spent a lot of time going around to African-American churches, church basements, talking to people. And he has said publicly that getting people from the central city to where he had the jobs in South Milwaukee was like trying to get, you know, people from, you know, Wisconsin to Europe. I mean, we think it's not that hard. As someone who takes the bus, I take the 57. I have a nice route. But, you know, once you start, someone has to be at a job on time. If they have to switch three buses, and a bus is not like rail where it's always there right on time, but, you know, it's in traffic. And Angie does a great job, I'm sure. But, you know, it's difficult to always be right on time. There are elements and other things. So I absolutely agree. I think public transportation is a huge factor in this conversation. And why is it that when we want to push for more connections to the suburbs, we want to have more diverse transportation modes to the suburbs, what is the impasse? Why is that a political issue? That's interesting to me.
Alex, I just want to say this too. I think that we definitely should move forward in that direction. I think public transportation and access is important to those jobs. I will say this though. This is the same conversation that Martin Luther King had 50 years ago. And I think for the African-American community, we must, brothers and sisters, must begin to take a look at it and say, listen, if every time we make a step, if they're going to get in front of us, we got to figure out how to take care of ourselves. And I think people are scared of that message. They're scared. But that's the message that I don't care if you're conservative, if you're liberal. Empowerment of African-American people is important. In other words, listen, it seems like the government is getting away. They don't want to get you. They have jobs out there, but they don't want you to be there. We're going to work on it. But in the meantime, we can create some jobs here. There's tons of houses that need to be torn down. There's grass that needs to be cut. There's garages that need to be built. Let's figure out how to put brothers and sisters to work instead of waiting on somebody else. I just really believe that message of empowerment should be coming from everyone. But instead, we're leading African-Americans down this path, specifically African-Americans. I'm not for sure about other communities, about we have to work the government and work someone else and tell someone else what to do in order to because that's connected with our destiny. And I refuse that story. I think we have to begin to say, listen, what can we do as a people? Because no one else, our children are dying. And people, you know, just they're not doing as much as they could. We have to figure it out. And I think that message should be broadcast to our community.
Well, and also talk about from an infrastructure standpoint is how do we create an environment where we don't have to be driving people out to the suburbs? What's wrong with having jobs inside our city? And not just, you know, mowing lawns and painting houses, but good paying jobs. And, you know, why are these companies leaving our city? How do we get them to come back? And I think that conversation is inextricably linked to the conversation about education, to crime, perception, and changing those statistics. And
Tracy, I agree with you. The only thing I think is we have to be careful, even though I do believe ultimately about Martin Luther King's dream. I believe that. But I think that too many African-Americans, and this goes back to Angela's point, we can do all that. I think right now, if we educated a whole bunch of brothers and sisters, we educated them and gave them everything that they were looking for, there'd still be a reason why I'm not going to hire. I look at my own life, and I did everything I possibly could to look good. I remember plenty of times I just got rejected. There was a class action lawsuit I was a part of, and people couldn't believe it. Keith, you're a great candidate, graduated honor roll. There's always a reason not to hire a minority person. And I just think that we're fooling ourselves if we think that if these African-American communities and other groups, minority groups, did everything they possibly could, that the world is going to be open to them like it is other communities. I think that's even though we want it to be America, I think we can strive for it, but we should be honest with these communities and say, listen, you guys got to figure this out. You have to figure this out. If you don't, you get what you get right now, which is what's happening right now.
And I just have to add that by and large, many companies are choosing to come to Milwaukee. You know, Manpower, for its international headquarters, had the choice among Paris, London, or Milwaukee. They chose Milwaukee. You know, we have major Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies choosing Milwaukee, choosing to expand in Milwaukee. Master Lack chose to stay here. Harley Davidson has done a lot here, built a whole museum here. I mean, so there are so many success stories, and I think it goes back to perception.
I just want to pick up the transportation piece here a minute because I think that it's going to be immediately an issue because there's this on the horizon that the management of the transit company may change. And what does that mean for people who need to get around? And what does that mean for the good family-supporting jobs that are currently now in the county transportation system? Because when people want to cut budgets, the first thing they do is knock down those wages.
We've let the county executive know as far as the the whole profitization of our system, that first of all, we're not going for it. And second of all, you're denying, you don't have, once the ability to keep a transit system accountable to the people that it serves leaves, which it would with a completely private for-profit company, once you lose that, it's gone. You don't get it back. You have no control over what communities lose access and which ones don't.
Can I just ask you all to give me 5 more minutes? I know it's, yeah. Is everyone okay with that? And it's because I have one more question, and it's, I invited you all here for many different reasons, but one of the things that stood out to me most is when I first talked to Thomas, you mentioned that you believed Martin Luther King Jr.'s dreams had been reached, the dreams, the plan that he laid
the
out in that speech.
Yes.
And I want to ask you, you know, your thoughts on that. Why do you believe that?
Because we're all in this room right now.
Okay. Anyone else have a take on that?
I think yes to a point, and only to a point. I think it's very telling that the things that he was talking about and fighting for 50 years ago are really, we're still seeing the effects of them. And granted, like things like in the inner city, redlining or blockbusting or getting rid of jobs, it doesn't really happen anymore. But we're still feeling the effects, and that's why all these issues are intertwined, whether it be crime or joblessness or not having a job or the perception of the city, they're all intertwined. So yes, we do have an African-American president. And I mean, by and large, I'm a person of color. I was able to get a college education. Angela has a very good job. Keith has an education and a good job. But millions upon millions of people are in the same place or even worse off than their ancestors were in the 60s. And I think that's a problem. So yes, to a point.
So the structural barriers technically have come down in a lot of ways.
In most ways.
In most ways, with desegregation, we had equal opportunity, mm-hmm. things like that. So, you know, is it, to Keith's point, is it that mindset? And are we just missing that last?
Tracy, you're absolutely right. But Nick is right on this, too. It's the legacy cost of that. In other words, going back to my grandfather in 1947, after he got a job at American Can Company, a good paying job that he retired from, couldn't move to Washington Highlands, Washington Highlands, I think it is, because on the deed restrictions, Jews and blacks could not move into Washington Highlands. So in 1977, the year I was born, that was stricken, so they could do that. Now blacks and Jews can move to, but it's the legacy mindset of then my grandfather saying, no, son, telling my father, no, you can't go there. They don't allow black people to go there. Then me growing up, Keith, no, you can't go to Port Washington. Don't go to Port Washington. Don't go that far. And so even though, and this is where I kind of get offended sometimes with my conservative brothers and sisters, because they think things are in a vacuum. So you can say everything is normal now. We got President Obama. But if I slapped around your grandparents and then slapped around your parents, you're just going to come up and give me a hug? No. There's issues within our legacy costs of how our mindset have. I mean, and this is, I'm 36 year old. I'm like, hey, you know, everything is free now. We got a black president. But I still suffer from the legacy costs of being in an environment where, no, black people can't do that. You can't do this. So it's good. And I even will say this. I'm glad that we can even shop. We can shop at Bayshore. We can shop at, as far as African Americans. But there's still a mindset there that we're still dealing with, that a lot of minority communities are dealing with. How do we then become now what Martin Luther King fought for? It's difficult because we grew up in an environment where, you know, you can't. My dad used to say, no, black people couldn't go past 27th Street. And when my granddad moved on Grant, he got stopped. My father got stopped every day because you were black and you don't supposed to be here. That's hard to change that mindset to say now I think we're all individuals now. I just don't see that. And there's some legacy costs that America we have to deal with because of what happened just one generation ago.
I just want to read.
The other thing is that I got involved in civil rights being a volunteer in a voter registration drive in Alabama. I feel like we made lots of progress, and now I'm feeling like, am I going to leave this world when people are again fighting for voting rights? In the last 2 to 4 years, there's been an attempt to reinstall all those structural barriers that we thought were gone.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, just I think it's good to, talking about Dr. King's speech, just read a small portion related to this. And he said, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And of course, we hear that over and over again. I think we've touched on so many good, it's all these things, I think, you know. There's some institutional issues still. The fact that we have an African-American, I'm being too conservative here, but the fact that we have an African-American president, I think is just so significant. And I think it, Keith and I talked to so many people, African-Americans in City Hall during the election saying it just can't happen. It's not going to happen. Not in America, not now. And for that to happen, I think that is significant. It doesn't erase all the realities down here at our level, but I think it is significant. And now, are people judged on the content or the character? Martin Luther King Jr. did not say, don't judge people. He said, judge them on the content of their character. And as I meet with the young men in my neighborhood, you know, I try to evaluate where they're at. I try to help them see their weaknesses and their strengths. Mm-hmm. And I try to look at their character. And we have so much talent, so much immense talent in the city. Young African-American men are not a plague on the city. Young African-American men are a huge asset. They are the most untapped resource that we have, and they are many times making the city a great city. Too many times, I think they themselves don't see the value of their own character.
Final thoughts?
I was just going to agree with what Nick said. I feel that progress, and what Ms. Peggy said, that progress has been made up to a point. I have never been so acutely aware of my race and my gender as I am now at 39 years old. And the fact that I do not move in this country and move in this city or state as just a person. I am always bound by race and gender. I am defined by race and gender. We've made a lot of mention of the fact that we have an African-American president. I think that his time in the White House has brought to light some things that we thought we had put to bed and had buried, and we have definitely not put to bed and buried. But the good thing for me about this is let's put it on the table in all its ugliness and complexity, and let's deal with it now.
I just want to say, at least for my final thought, I wish, and this is the message I wish I can get to some of the folks who do not believe in Milwaukee or even may not even believe in Martin Luther King's dream, is that I would prefer that if you aren't going to say anything good or ain't going to say anything good, don't say nothing at all. And it bothers me that we have come so comfortable now that not only are we talking about people, we're creating laws and legislation to destroy communities, to hurt specific groups. I may not like Milwaukee. I may not like hanging around black people or brown people or gay people or Jewish people. But now we have these people who are there. They're destroying our communities based off of their ideas. And I just wish, fine, if you don't want to live next to people of color, different people, fine, but leave us alone. That's the message I have. Just leave people alone. Now we're getting really messy when people's backyards, when family business, kind of Alex, what you talked about. And they're just really, and I think that's unfair for anybody. You may disagree with what we believe in, what we stand for, but just leave us alone. I think that's a big message for me.
If I can make a final statement, and I don't want to call out anybody in this room or make a political judgment on anybody, but I just want to say that Booker T. Washington actually had a quote that talks about people who make a living off of keeping the troubles, the wrongs, and the hardships of the black community before the public and for their own personal gain, because quite frankly, they know that misery and sympathy pay them well. And I think in order for racism to finally end in this country is that people need to unite as, you know, as not as an African-American or an Asian-American or a Latino-American, but as Americans to move to help, you know, the situation move forward.
I think that's a good point. To close this all off, I want to say that we've talked a lot about black and white here, but this is not a black and white issue. And I think we all know that. And I think the diversity in this room says that. And I would like to thank you all for joining me here today to have this discussion. I think it was a really interesting talk, and you all have made my job really, really, really hard of editing this down to what actually makes it to air. So now I have that task. It'll be fun. And a full length of this, I do believe I'm going to put on our website. This is going to air tomorrow morning, both in a new segment for a new segment, I'm not sure at what time, but also a longer, more in-depth version on Lake Effect. And then I do believe this, like I said, I'm going to put the entire discussion on our website. So
thanks for having us.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.